Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 14, The Reply Brief. This week, we broke down Part 13, where we heard a profile, Angry Bob, Lividity, Angry Bob, Alternate Suspects, and more Angry Bob. This week, I'm joined by Bob and Janet. We have a lot of questions to get into, but first, I know we have some really good housekeeping notes.
We got a bunch of stuff. We got some good news, bad news. I'll give you some bad news first, so we can finish with the good news. Bad news is, hopefully it's not real bad news. It may be a holiday thing, but as I mentioned to you guys a couple weeks ago, March 4th was the deadline for me to get my open records request from the new case, and that did not arrive. They have not responded. I've sent a message off to them informing them that they have missed the deadline per Michigan law, waiting to hear back on that. But there was, in the 15 business days, there was President's Day was in there. But that should have been still today, so I don't know what's going on with that. So we may have a fight on our hands when it comes to getting those case files. So we're still plugging along with that. So, but also just remember, for those of you that are like, start the next case, just know, like, we're going full steam ahead. I'm looking at interviewing a key witness, I'm hoping on Thursday evening for that case. So we're still moving full steam ahead, but I can't launch into a new season until we get that stuff ready. So we're just going to keep plugging along with the stuff we have for the Adnan case. And, you know, we may do a couple interviews or something until we get to where we're ready to start there. That's all the bad news that there is. Good news is, we do have the full set of trial transcripts now, thanks to Zach. There was a case advocate from the other side of the state that had Zach and I had kind of a moment. When we went to dinner Saturday, where he passed it off to me, but this is one of the very, very Rabia-esque. When this box of trial transcripts, the person that I interviewed a couple weeks ago had said that, you know, they had this box and they carried it around for 15 years, and then they gave it to this other person and they've had it for years. They're just waiting for somebody to take it that can do something with it and get this person out of prison. They believe that we are those people, and hopefully they're right. But they were passing through between Detroit and Chicago with the box, and Zach, who lives right near I-94, was able to go meet them and get the box. Nice. And then this weekend we went out to dinner, and it was just, I don't know, it's kind of a cool thing. We just pulled in the parking lot and Zach passed the box over to me, and it is this old, worn, it's a 20-year-old box with case files and trial transcripts and stuff in it. And we just kind of had that, this is just, it's cool that this thing has been like being passed around, just hoping someone can do something. And we're very much hoping to be that someone.
Shades of Rabia driving around with Adnan's case in her car in a big old box, huh?
Yeah.
That's so exciting.
Yeah, and Becky like looked in the back seat and was like, is there mold on that box? And I'm just like, I hope so, because it just makes it cooler. I'll post a picture of it. Maybe Friday I'll post
a picture of the box.
In a true Zach fashion, with some bad levity, we have this amazing moment. And I hand Bob the box, and he's like, let's get this done. And I'm like, yeah, let's do this. And then I walked off the wrong direction to my car in true Zach fashion.
Yeah.
That's adorable.
Yeah. But it was an amazing moment. It was like, if someone was capturing it,
yeah,
like, let's get it done. And then just walks away the wrong way. And then it has that, oh, shit moment.
Yeah, you see it. We have a still shot, and then we have to see Zach crossing back through the right. shot yep. to be like, yep. I went the wrong way.
So I had that. I had mentioned that I was going to try to find somebody to maybe help me out getting those digitized, because it is all paper. But then I just found out. I talked to my tech guy at school, because we have big, giant scanner copiers, and asked if I could use those to skip, because then they can do, because these are printed on both sides, so it's a real pain in the butt. And they told me to feel free after school to come in, and I can use that machine to scan all this into PDF. So things are moving forward. We're jamming forward just as quick as we can. I've had multiple contacts or email with the person that's in prison, hoping to arrange a phone call with them. So that is all moving right along. And then we had last week, I believe it was Thursday, Jamie Snow had a big hearing. And this was about getting some DNA testing done. And we don't have a response from that yet, but Jennifer Hill, one of our listeners, attended the hearing and gave a full report. If you're not on our Facebook page, on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page, you might want to join there. I think we still have it pinned to the featured posts, where she went through and kind of really broke down how things went. But kind of the Reader's Digest version is that Jamie's sides, I believe they had two different DNA experts, made a very compelling case. They're trying to get the DNA tested. Sound like the prosecution's rebuttal to that was kind of what we saw in the West Memphis 3 case. Like, well, we can't test the DNA because that would destroy the DNA and we won't be able to test it later. So At least from the perspectives I read from people who were there, seems like Jamie's side made some very good and compelling arguments. Wasn't much along the way of rebuttal, and so we're waiting on a decision with that. And then just in the live chat, right before we started, Kathy McElhaney, who has gotten very close with Jesse Eldridge, our season 3 case. In that case, I want to say it exactly how she said it, if I can find it very quickly. So Jesse's case, if you guys remember, he was convicted based pretty much solely on the testimony of his brother. And it was years and years after the fact, you know, he had changed his story. Basically, we found out when I was reviewing all the case files and the notes that they had lied to him. The police told him that essentially told him his DNA was on Kiao Gove's body, and therefore it must have been him or his brother, at which point he told this whole story about how his brother did it. He actually recanted live on this show to me, or not live on the show, but live on tape over the phone to me. He recanted and admitted that he had lied. That was turned over to the Innocence Project, who took it over to the Conviction Integrity Unit. They did a couple of polygraphs with Troy to see if he's telling the truth now, and he passed with flying colors. And the things have been kind of sitting dormant. It's been three, almost 4 years since that happened, and we haven't heard very much. We've been trying to get some MVAC testing on the clothing on Kiao Go's body and on her clothing to see if there's any of the perpetrator's DNA, because if you guys know that case, it was there should be DNA on it based on the methodology of the murder. And we just haven't heard anything about it in a long time. It's been waiting, waiting, waiting. According to Kathy, the news we have on that is that the CIU is now waiting on the funding for the MVAC testing. So they have sounds like they have agreed to do that. And then they want to meet with Jesse. And I'll use Kathy's words here. And they will back him for the exoneration. So this sounds very promising. I hope and pray every day that Jesse comes home. He never should have been there to begin with. It's been over 25 years. And in these last 3 to 4 years have been really, really frustrating because, you know, once Troy recanted, we all thought, that's it. That was the whole case. And he's admitted he lied. And things have been sitting still. But it sounds like the wheels are starting to turn there again for Jesse Eldridge as well. So that should be, we'll keep you posted on that. If I get any more information, I will let you guys know. And with that, I don't think we have any other housekeeping that I can think of right off the top of my head. So we'll get right into it. I saw there was this episode when it came out on the main feed. Now I saw several posts with people saying that they really got into this. They got a lot out of this one. I appreciate all those kind words. When I went back and re-listened to it, I have to say that I was very happy with this episode. And once, you know, I did these months ago. So when I'm like listening back, like I remember that process of like the week, like breaking all that down and trying to do it in a format that made sense. And I hope that I did that. Start with Zach, since Zach didn't know much about the case until now. You probably know way too much about it now after going through this whole reply brief series. What did you think about this episode?
This episode, honestly, is my favorite of the season so far. I mean, I know we only got like one episode to go, but definitely my favorite. It was the first, I guess I can't say it's the first, but it's one of the first episodes for me can fully paint a picture of everything going on. You know, we've been so in the weeds so often on this case because a lot of people know this case. You know, there's all these cell phone pings and there's the Asia stuff and all this stuff. But as far as for me, I want to hear a profile of the case. I want to hear the possibility of who these alternate suspects, even Adnan, like where does evidence fall? I that's what I want to know. So for me, this was a great episode. On the other side of that, listening to the Brett and Alice episode, pretty frustrating. Even just the fact that they would take all this time to go through these alternate suspects and then, you know, ridicule the people that tend to believe in these alternate suspects, regardless of which suspect it is. Just the amount of ridicule that they're putting on, I guess that's the best word I can use, is, you know, they continue to go, if you believe this, this is ridiculous. This is absolutely laughable. Oh, let's go to an ad break because this is so funny. Oh, mm-hmm. It hurt. It really was disgusting to me.
Yeah, I agree with that. Janet, what'd you think?
Well, I didn't listen to the episode that you're responding to. So, you know, all the information that was, I just had not made it that far by choice. But I mean, it's a great episode. It certainly takes us, you know, into a place where it's unrealistic to think that we would have, that all of this stuff would be covered and that we couldn't talk about alternate suspects or other viable suspects, because unfortunately it is always a massive part of a case that's being debated And I feel kind of bummed out that you were put in the position where, you know, you sort of have to go back through this. Yet at the same time, I think the way that you explained everything was so clean and sort of tight in a way that I don't know that you've had the opportunity necessarily to do. I think maybe you sort of had talked about it on a True Crime Binge, if I'm not making that up. But hearing everything in this kind of package as a direct response to all of the ridiculing happening on the other side was extremely compelling. And of course, people want justice for Hay. So that's also a place that their energy goes, because they feel like there is work to be done, an investigation, you know, if nothing else, even if it is just, you know, finally we have answers so that we can push past this giant question mark. That being said, you called people trash. I felt super weird about it, but I totally understood why you were angry. I always struggle with that. It's always a struggle. I'm not saying it wasn't, you know, justified, but I don't think that you're as angry now as you were when you recorded it. So,
no. Well, and part of that is, so you didn't...
Or disgusted, maybe not angry, but...
You did subject yourself to hearing it. And so, and that was kind of, Zach hit it on the head. Like, if you were to listen to them, part of what I was trying to do, like with the profile and stuff, is I want people to just understand, even if you disagree with me, I want people to understand how I come to the conclusions that I come to. If we can at least agree to disagree, but understand that my process is data driven, maybe my analysis of the data is flawed. And that was kind of the profile thing too. Instead of just saying, here's my profile, I try to go through and say, this is why I think this. This is why I think this. And so being that that's my kind of MO, what I'm always trying to do is to be very transparent, really let people understand where I'm coming from. And then at the time when I listened to their episode, it was literally like it felt like every other paragraph they said was just a slap in the face to anyone who's trying to reason through this. And it just makes you angry. I don't speak for anybody. It made me angry when they laughed this stuff off. And like, I think towards the end of the episode, I kind of gave the comparison, but they laugh at anyone who thinks anything other than the state's narrative. It's not just you're wrong. It's not they disagree, but you're foolish for thinking that. You're dim-witted if you think that. You know, it's silly to think that. And then when I really stepped back and thought about it, it was like, well, what? They keep saying that we're conspiracy theorists and we're tap, tap, tap people and we're all these whack jobs to believe this. But it's like, but what do you have to believe in order to believe the state's narrative? And that's what I went through. Like, you have to believe that Becky was wrong about the day or lying, that Debbie was wrong about the day or lying, that Inez was wrong about the day or lying, that Coach Russell was wrong about the day or lying, that Coach Cy was wrong about the day or lying, that Asia McClain was wrong about the day or lying. You have to believe that it's perfectly reasonable for the star witness to not know where he saw a body and to not remember that and to change his story several times and to say that he was at places that were impossible to be. You have to believe that somehow it's reasonable that you could be at Woodlawn at 7:01 getting off the phone and be in the middle of burying a body at 7:09 at Leakin Park. Like, to me, it's just like, how do you not see that? Like, how do you not see, if you want to believe that, if that's your conclusion, that's okay. But then to turn and laugh at people that are like, I'm looking at the facts and I don't see it that way. That's why called him trash.
That's very shameful behavior. That's very shameful behavior.
Back then. And a lot of it is me, as I said, all the way back in episode one or part one, that I'm trying to look at this thing as almost like doing a statement analysis on them. Like, why are they choosing the words they're choosing? Why are they choosing the delivery they're choosing? And then and then when you really start to do that, to me, it becomes very obvious what's going on here. And it was like, oh, this episode is, it's just a process of elimination. That's why all the focus is on Asia. All the focus is on cell phone pings. All the focus is on where the car was at, but zero focus is put onto the actual star witness's story, the actual narrative that happened, because it's jingling the keys. Look over here, not over here. Don't pay attention to the man behind the curtain type of thing. And in this episode, it was, okay, now that we've gotten this far, you might be thinking it could have been some of these other possibilities. So we're going to just eliminate those. And what you'll hear in this week's episode, the final conclusion that's coming up on Sunday, if you listen to theirs too, they finally deliver their final theories. completely and 100% void of any evidence. Yeah. They just tell you how and why Adnan did it without any evidence to back it up. But they were able to do that because of this episode, because they've eliminated all other possibilities. So we don't have to tell you how we know Adnan did it, because it had to be him. There was nobody else left. And then they give you that conclusion. So that's a long answer to why I called them trash. But
no.
But I stand by it.
I know.
I still
know,
think they're
I
trash.
Know, I know.
So before we get...
Nothing, everything you're saying makes perfect sense. Absolutely. I know.
Before we get into listener questions, and I'm probably going to stomp on some on accident here, but I do have a question based on like the lividity. There seems to be a lot of argument about the lividity. And, you know, it seems like, you know, the state is trying to say that it could be caused from this position. The defense is saying there's no way it could be caused from this position. There seems to be a lot of people saying that the lividity is full frontal fixed, which means that she couldn't have been in that position. I just don't understand how the guilty side is trying to argue around that, I guess.
Well, it's internet guilty people. Like that argument was never made in court. It was missed by Gutierrez originally. Once Dr. Lavardi came through and analyzed it and wrote an affidavit, and they tried to present it. Essentially, they were told that's not evidence that can come in on appeal. It's not new evidence. It's just another opinion on the same old evidence. So it's never been argued before a court that the lividity rules things out or rules the state's timeline out. So it's just internet people, and internet people say whatever they want. But the fact is, back to what I was saying earlier, right? As far as like, we're the wackos, right? We're the conspiracy theorists that, with these stretches. So for the guilty side, if you believe that way, that means you believe that the autopsy report, the coroner's report, the photos from the autopsy, Dr. Lavardi's testimony, all of those are wrong, right? So even though the coroner says when they disinterred her that she was on her right side, that the autopsy says she was found on her right side, that Jay says she was on her right side. So you just have to ignore all of that. And then they'll say, because they're on certain corners of the internet, people have access to these photos. And they're like, oh, well, we can see. They make these arguments that the way she was dug up, you can tell that she was. So they make this. I talked about this a while back about the positioning, that she was twisted, right? So, You know, she's on her side, but somehow she's still twisted. So somehow her chest would be down. And that's why, to me, I really, you know, whatever, argue about it. I'm certainly not going to start posting photos of Hay's body being disinterred to try to argue with people. So I lean back on the pressure marks. The pressure marks make the case. There's very clear and obvious pressure marks on her, which, as I explained, was literally something, objects pressed against her skin while the lividity fixed. And they are big, double diamond shaped, very clear edged items, whatever they were that caused that pressure marks. Those items did not exist in the grave. So you can argue positioning all you want, unless the things that caused those pressure marks were in that grave, then she was not buried in that grave before lividity fixed, which is 8 to 12 hours, generally 10 to 12 hours. It could be in certain circumstances, usually if it's really warm out, it could be as little as 6, but certainly not 3. It can't be. So if that's not in the grave, then the story doesn't work, but they'll ignore that too. And the way Brett and Alice get around that is they don't call them pressure marks. They call them injuries to the skin. They speak about them as though they are injuries that happened before she died. When they talk about the concrete shoes, and they laugh about how silly it is to think that that's what caused those marks, they say, oh, so what? That Alonzo Sellers killed her and he took the concrete shoes and just gently rubbed them against her skin to cause these little injuries. When they know goddamn well, I was getting angry Bob again, when they know very well that those are post-mortem pressure marks. They are not injuries to the skin.
I don't know what's scarier. The idea, like, part of me is like, I hope they believe every single sentence. I hope they believe it, because at least then you're believing. At least you're being honest. Even if you're completely misunderstanding or you're completely misrepresenting, in your mind, you genuinely believe all the things you're saying. I don't think that's what's going on. That's awful too. Like, that's terrifying. That is a terrifying situation. It is also like terrifying and horrible to imagine just being like, I mean, this is all bullshit, but like, who cares? Yeah.
So from the chat right now, Shannon in the chat said, Brett and Alice said that those were from items in the grave when she asked them directly on their Facebook page. So now they're just continuing to lie about it. And then she followed it up with, they said that they're from rocks.
Oh.
So interesting, when they did all their research and made the podcast, they said they are just faint injuries to the skin And they must have been really pressed against about the fact that they are post-mortem pressure marks. And now they say they're from rocks. Well, Brett and Alice, what rocks? What rocks are they from? Like, you can't just decide. That goes right back. Sorry, this is happening in real time, so I'm trying to control myself.
I don't, I'm not sure you need to.
I'm not sure you need to control yourself. Trying not to be spicy right now.
Everybody loves Angry Bob.
What this is again, they work backwards from a conclusion. Their conclusion from the beginning, before they ever started episode one, was that Adnan is guilty. And so every explanation for everything has to equal Adnan is guilty, because they refuse to even consider that they may be wrong about that. So, okay, they finally, someone convinced them those absolutely are pressure marks. So instead of saying, well, then we should figure out what made those pressure marks, instead they go, they were from rocks in the grave. How do I know that? Because I know Adnan killed Hay, and I know that they were burying them because we need the Leakin Park ping, so the burial had to happen at 7 o'clock, so therefore they must be from rocks in the grave.
Cool.
Oh. Do you see how I stopped talking there instead of finishing my rant that I had loaded up?
Deep breath.
We should start listening to questions. Thanks a lot. Who was that, Shannon? Thanks a lot, Shannon. I was in a good mood.
Okay. All right. Well, we do have some specific questions that sort of build out from some of the stuff we've been talking about, some of the evidence, some of the facts. Certainly from a sort of blanket umbrella perspective, you know, this is one of those episodes where you lay a bunch of stuff out and everyone feels fired up and feels like there is action that can be taken. And so, you know, folks like Aaron, I'm going to read Aaron's, but Sky also had a great one. Aaron says, when Adnan is finally free, like where it's all over and all of the sort of back and forth about, you know, the latest issues is done, what are the odds of the investigation starting back up again? Do you have any sense, do you have any faith that that could happen? Are you just like, I'm open to every disappointment and every good thing that might happen?
I have hope. I don't pretend to know what's going to happen. I will say this. And I know she has her issues, and that is what it is. But I will say that if Mosby was still in office, my confidence level would be much higher than an investigation, because she's straight up said they're investigating this.
Right.
Now that Bates is in charge, and there's nothing negative about Ivan Bates, I just don't know well enough to know if he will proceed with an investigation. My hope is that if this gets held up in the Maryland Supreme Court, that Adnan's conviction stays overturned and the charges stay dropped against him. It's an open case at that point. Like, it's completely irresponsible. So that's what this would be. If Bates decides we're not going to investigate this further, then what they've said is, I don't give a shit who killed Heyman Lee, and that's bullshit, right? Because the legal status will be that the charges are dropped against Adnan, which means no one, it's like a reset. No one has been charged with her murder. That's the situation we'll be in. And if they just go, well, we just accept that. I don't accept that. And that comes back to the whole purpose of me doing this to begin with. What frustrated me about this from the very beginning was there was this movement and all this pressure from all these people that were really, really, really pushing the state to investigate and find out who killed Heyman Lee. And it felt like we were this close. And then Brett and Alice come around and yank the rug out, and they put out all this disinformation. They embolden the people who already believe that Adnan is guilty. And they took people who have always believed that Adnan is innocent, and they took the wind out of their sails and made it so they weren't so sure anymore. And that's one of the, listen, there's tons of people. And by the way, I do want to know, there's people all over the chat when I was talking about Jesse Eldredge that said that they would donate for that MVEC DNA testing. And I certainly have a note of that. I want to see if that's something that we can do. As a matter of fact, Don McElhinney chatted. He contacted the Dallas CIU about raising money for DNA testing for Jesse, and we'll update as soon as we get it. So Don's on the case. He's going to see. And if that is possible, Don, certainly let me know right away. And I promise you, this part gives me chills. Whatever that number is, we will come up with it very quickly.
Yeah.
Our audience has always shown up, always, when we need to. And that leads me back to what I'm saying here. So one of the things that I need you guys to do to really help out here is share this reply brief with people. Talk about it on social media. Like, get people that haven't listened to this and hear the facts, so that we keep that pressure going so that we can actually get the case reinvestigated. Because if we do nothing else by this process than to rearm the troops and put the pressure back on, then we've succeeded. That's my hope.
And if you feel like you need to chuckle and chortle a little bit about their theories, I feel like you've earned the right. Anybody who's like, but I thought so-and-so said such-and-such, I feel like you're allowed to be like, yeah, that was funny.
I remember my first beer.
That was a super weird, kind of sad attempt to change everyone's minds, but it was silly, so.
Yep. All right, we got to keep clicking here. We're 30 minutes in. What else we got?
Okay. Victoria says, can you share your opinions on something the undisclosed team touched on about Hay being carjacked or abducted and or murdered when she went to deposit her check at the bank on her route to pick up her family member? The undisclosed team did discover one serial killer was out and about or out of prison at the time of Hay's murder. However, it would not fit your profile on why they would bury her body, but always stuck with me for some reason. Victoria, I remember that episode very well. I listened to it a bunch of times because it was interesting because there was stuff being discussed that like startled other members of Undisclosed. It was one of those where you really could tell that like Rabia didn't know about a couple things that Susan had researched. You know, it was a very organic conversation and it was very fascinating. And I'm interested to hear what you'll say, Bob. I guess I would say that a lot of the time, you know, you are sort of playing the odds as far as like serial killers are extraordinarily rare, but
they certainly, if I remember correctly, presented that there was means and opportunity in the, I think yeah. If I'm remembering correctly, that there was like an uncashed check. There
yeah,
was
it was very compelling and remains compelling. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. And keep in mind. So when I say this, that a profile is just, it's an odds game that is very subjective and is based on opinion. You guys heard me lay out my thought process and my reasoning for the conclusion that I came to as far as the type of offender that we're going to be looking for, that we should be looking for. Because of that analysis, I don't think that that is very likely. I just don't think that that someone doing that buries the body, dumps the car. Like, there's a lot going on there that just doesn't fit the profile for me. But I just want to put with the caveat that it's certainly not unreasonable for someone to consider that theory or for that to be your theory of the case. It just doesn't, in my mind, I can't make it make sense.
Yeah, I thought it was really compelling too. And unfortunately, I've followed enough stories about people who do abduct strangers and bury them and dump cars in strange places and stuff like that. We know it's possible. We know that. But I wouldn't discount it either. And it's really interesting. And I also just appreciate even Bob, you know, everyone's like, I'm open to facts. I'm open to investigation. Bob, you were very, very clear. You're like, this is my opinion right now with the information I have. And you're always mm-hmm. the first person to be like, we don't know what we don't know. But, you know, the things that you can examine closely need to be examined.
Yeah. And like what you just said about serial killers, I've used this example before in other cases, like, Israel Keyes is like the exception that proves the rule, right? So he was a serial killer killing at random, pick people that were unrelated to him completely. But he went through a lot of body concealment, beyond putting bodies in lakes and things like that. Like, you don't typically see that with serial killer. And in his case, my profile of that was always that the reason he did that, because, you know, for me, when I'm trying to study, like, why did he do that? Like, why, if he's in a state he's not from, and finds a random person and kills them in the middle of a national park, why not just leave? And so the best theory that I've come up with as far as Israel Keyes is concerned is because he wanted to keep doing it.
Right.
And that if the presumption was that everybody that he killed that were just like went missing, were eaten by a bear or whatever happened, then no one was looking for the guy that was in the national parks
right.
murdering people. But that's another profiling situation. But I'm only pointing that out to say that just because even if I'm right about about the profile, it still could be wrong. Just because that's what makes the most sense. If everyone in the world agreed that's what makes the most sense for this behavior, it still could be something completely out of left field. And I'm completely open to that.
Right. Macon says, I've always felt that the lack of pressure marks from Hay's bra was important, but no rips on the bra and put back on carefully. This is from Macon. She didn't have it on when killed, and there's no evidence it was taken off her forcibly. Do we know all of that? And I'm not being skeptical. I genuinely was like, wait, do we know definitively that, is it because there were no bra pressure marks? Does that kind of mean that they...
So her position on the body, that's one of the things. So the pressure marks are up here, like on collarbone area, right? And in their episode, Brett and Al say it's probably from her. It could have been from her bra straps. Matter of fact, it probably was from her bra strap. It certainly wasn't, because there was no pressure on the bra straps because her bra was on her, but it was pulled up above her breasts. And that's where, like, some people said, well, maybe that was an attempt at sexual assault. Maybe it's somebody like doing something with the body after it's done. To me, everything together, when you look at the way the skirt was and the bra was and the shirt was, it looks to me like she was probably being, and I apologize for the graphic nature of this, but she was probably being drugged by her feet. That's what it looked like. It looked just like it had just gotten scooted up because of that process of her being dragged. But in any case, the bra was on and it was attached. But because it was pulled up, the shoulder straps were just loose. But where the bra actually went across her chest, I don't know how tight it was, and I would have to look at the autopsy photos and see if there's any, because there may be pressure marks there too, but they're just, the thing about the double diamond pressure marks is that they didn't add up, right? That right. was the thing with those. So like, if her bra is there and you see pressure mark, nobody's pointing out like, well, there was also of course there were, her bra was on. But the reason that the double diamond pressure marks came up is because those shouldn't be there.
Right.
There's nothing in the burial site on her body that explained those.
Got it. Colin says, hi, Bob, you say Hay didn't have any risk factors, but according to the state, two people made statements to the police saying someone had threatened to kill her or make her disappear. Shouldn't that be investigated? And Jonathan had a very similar quote, which was, you know, we sort of after the fact now, because of everything that happened with Mosby's office, suddenly have this information about two possible threats that were unknown up to that point. So would you consider those risk factors?
Yeah, if it's legit. I mean, I believe, we don't know who said it. The internet's kind of believes they figured out who those people were. But it was someone said that they heard someone else say that they were going to kill her, is kind of what we know from that. And that's part of the whole thing. When all that information first came out, a bunch of people came at me, or not came at me, but were like, does this change it? You know, you had your whole theory of the case. Does this change everything? And my response has been, my hypothesis of kind of what I think happened, that's why it's a hypothesis. It could be completely wrong. But right now, I don't know who said that. If it's legit, has the person who said they heard the person say it been vetted? I don't have enough information there about it. But yeah, that certainly would be a risk factor. If someone legitimately was threatening her, then that would be. But again, that would be someone with a known personal relationship.
We saw also some questions about the specific part of the episode when you were speaking about no signs of a struggle. And I'll read Anthony's as an example. But Anthony says, are there any other cases you know of where a victim was strangled after having been knocked unconscious? For Anthony, that seems a little odd. Is that something that tends to happen with any regularity? I mean, I don't know what I mean.
I couldn't tell you any specific ones, but it certainly is something that obviously has happened in the realm of the world. And I know there are cases where it's happened because I remember having this conversation with Jim Clementi, who has worked thousands of violent crimes over the years. And that was one of the things we were talking about. Was that was a possibility that it could happen. So it's not as common as someone being shot or being stabbed or even being strangled alive, but there are certainly situations where people, and by the way, notice I said strangled or smothered. I don't think she was strangled. If I'm being honest, I think she was smothered. The hyoid wasn't broken. There weren't the indications you would be looking for, and there were no marks, like hand marks, that you should see on her neck. I don't think that she was strangled. My personal opinion is that she was knocked unconscious, and then it was something like a pillow over the face or something like that. The only reason we think she was strangled is because Jay said, right? The police hypothesized that there was, from the petechia in the eyes and stuff, that there was indications that she suffocated. And so manual strangulation just became the theory. And it may be possible that was noted on the autopsy, but certainly there was not clear evidence that 100% that's what happened. It could have been as simple as somebody just holding their hand over their mouth and nose,
right,
if she was unconscious.
Right. Also a question from Anthony about, and I think Kristen and some other folks brought up something like this, or Kristen, maybe yours was just about being unconscious and then what happened from there. But this idea, a couple of people had sort of pushed back on the idea of needing to have assistance with respect to getting a ride. There were just some folks who pointed out, like, if you're from the area, you may know public transit, maybe something's walkable, or maybe, you know, postulating that that doesn't necessarily, for them, convince them that there had to be an outside party brought in, citing that as a specific example of, like, well, somebody could do it, you know, without getting picked up or
getting a ride. Yeah, it's possible. And I think I qualified that when I said it, but if not, I should, that's, you know, I believe the words I used were like, almost certainly somebody had to get a ride. And that almost wasn't an accident. It's because maybe someone lived five blocks away and was like, this is far enough, and walked home. Maybe they dumped the car and went and got on a bus, or, you know, like I said, or got in a taxi cab or something. Those are certainly possibilities that are out there. I just don't think they're the most likely. And part of that is because the behaviors don't add up to me. This is one of the things that confused me about it from the very beginning, was the way that I believe Hay was killed is very impulsive, young, immature, doesn't make sense. Like, well, I explained in this episode what I think happened. I believe this person snapped and then they panicked. And again, this is 100% opinion, and it is so, so, so subjective. So please don't take this as I'm saying this is what this is fact. But for me, I don't see the person that did that then being like, okay, I've collected myself now. Now I know I need to move the car. I need to move it to a remote location. First, I got to get the body out, and I need to bury the body so that the body's never found. But those are a lot of steps. So to me, I see indications of immaturity, impulsiveness, and then I also see behaviors that are more mature and more organized and more planned. So I've always thought that the most likely scenario there then is that you have a combination. You have young, immature, disorganized, that did the killing, and then older, more mature, more organized, that helped with the cover-up.
Sarah says, would you agree with this statement? The person who killed Hay knew her but did not care about her very much. I hypothesize this based on the fact that her clothes were not fixed before she was buried, clothes pulled up, even if this was due to dragging. So going back to that idea.
Jim would probably tell you yes, I think, or Jim would give you an answer. I've never bought into that stuff. And when I say I never bought into it, it doesn't make as much sense in my mind. Things like what they call like undoing, right? Yeah. Where like someone gets murdered and then they like cover up the body, or they put the clothes back on, or they, things like that as signs of remorse or because they really cared about them. It's not that that part doesn't make sense, but to me, it doesn't seem like as hard and as fast of rules, not the right word, but for lack of a better one, rule, that because they didn't, it means the opposite. I don't know if that makes sense what I'm saying. Like, I can see, like, if they did that, then certainly they did care about the person. If they didn't do that, I think it could mean either they didn't care about the person or they were just too panicked. You know,
well,
what I mean?
Also, like, if this is happening at night in the dark, in the middle of a forest,
and you're trying to do it as quickly as possible.
Yeah, by that point, that's different than, like, I think some what we hear sometimes is something like that happening, like, in a home or sort of at a place and time where you're sort of still in an environment that makes you want to correct, so that the environment and the person, like, everything is sort of reset in some kind of very obviously naive and not making sense kind of way. But if you're in that sort of state, but this, at this point, it's like, what are you going to, someone to a.
It also supports the idea of there being two offenders, the killer and the one that covers it up, that maybe the person that killed her did care about her very much, in whatever way that means to them. But then maybe it wasn't even just they had help burying the body, but maybe it was a completely different person by themselves that buried the body that has never met Hay before in their life and doesn't care. There's a lot of variables in that equation.
This discussion about the possibility of a hotel being in use, like just references to hotel, do we have more information about that? Shannon wants to know, was that like a tip that came in? Is that just sort of speculating as to where it could have happened?
The hotel for me comes from the fact that, as I mentioned, that I believe that the murder occurred at a place that could be directly connected back to the killer. And that usually equals either their home or a hotel. There are other situations as well. But because a hotel, like if you go give them your ID and register a room in your name, and then you murder somebody in that room, then they certainly, you're connected. Like if they find a body in there, they know you did it, right? In the profile, that's like one of the options. Then you also have the fact that I believe, if memory serves, there were even like receipts in the case file where like Hay had like rented rooms at hotels before in the past. I think like back when she was with Adnan, that they would go get a room at a hotel to go hook up. And then there was, you know, I believe it was in Debbie's interview, that the police kept questioning her about a hotel, almost like they knew something, because they kept coming back to it, that if Hay went to a hotel. And I don't know why that is. But yeah, I don't know if one's more likely than the other, but to me, a hotel makes just as much sense as someone's house.
Mm-hmm. That's basically it. I mean, we had a ton of questions around wanting more information or wanting to be able to contribute or think more about the possibility of who's responsible, but we're kind of out of time. And I think that was, I want to respect the fact that within the episode, you're like, I feel like I have to do this because of the position that I've been put in. So I don't want to like expound it and make it kind of worse on you.
Yeah. Well, and I'll just say this in regards, because, you know, I know a lot of people were asking lots of questions about Don specifically when it comes to the alternate suspect, because he ended up being kind of the one other than Adnan that still kind of remained that fit the profile for me. I want you to understand that the point there was to, more than anything, correct the record, right? So the point there was to say that you're not a wacko conspiracy theory if you're concerned and you think there's maybe some problems there, because, and I addressed, here's all the issues. I also want to make very clear that that doesn't mean that he had anything to do with this. Every single one of those things maybe would have been cleared up had the police done their job originally. But what I don't want to do, and thank you, Janet, for kind of giving me that out there, but what I don't want to do is sit here and litigate Don, who is a free and innocent man of this crime until further investigated, on a public podcast. You know, the information that I know about him is out there. At least the information that I'm willing to share publicly is all already out there. So at this point, all we can do from here is speculate. What needs to happen is that those things need to be investigated by the professionals that investigate them and figure out, are those problems really problems or are they not? So just understand, I know there was a lot of those questions. Just know we're not ignoring them, but it's just the answer to every one of those questions would require me to go into speculation about an innocent man. You know, as far as we know, an innocent man, everybody's innocent until proven guilty. And he certainly has not been proven guilty of anything. So I don't want to do that. And like Janet said, I think we got enough in. Zach, did you have any final thoughts before we wrap things up?
The only thing that really came to mind during this whole thing was the idea of how long it takes for lividity to settle. And the idea that if she was moved and buried that night, they're butting up against an ice storm that night. So, which could be part of the reason that her clothes are not put back into place, or what, you know what I mean? The body mm-hmm. wasn't hit very well because they're butting up against this ice storm that's coming in.
Yeah. Also, I do want to say one thing too. The body wasn't buried very well. That is a narrative created by the guilty crowd. The body was concealed pretty damn well.
Okay.
I mean, it was, yeah. So the only things sticking out of that weren't completely covered with dirt were a little bit of her hair, part of her right hand, just kind of her fingers, and part of one of her feet were the only thing that were exposed. Those were all very dirty and leaf littered. She was concealed pretty damn well.
All right. Well, thank you for clearing that up then.
And with that being said, we have coming up on Sunday is the series finale. You won't want to miss that. And that's the episode for the prosecutors where they broke down their final theories. And I kind of give you my final theory and my final conclusion as far as my opinion of why we're doing this, what we've done, and where we go from here. So make sure you tune into that on Sunday. And with that being said, thank you all so much. We've got a very lively live chat on YouTube today. So thank you guys all for joining us and participating. And I will be, as soon as I hear back from Don McElhaney, letting you know if there's an opportunity we have to fundraise for that DNA testing for Jesse Eldridge. I'm super excited about that.
Sounds good. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at PutThemInASong.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com designed, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kay Woodyomnik, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.